This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's done. Dead. Not going to happen. Forget Microsoft Yahoo, everybody. How about Yahoo Google? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us. It's Thursday today, the 12th of June. The news all came crashing together in the space of about an hour today. Word leaked that Microsoft had changed its mind this past weekend, said, nah, we really don't want to buy Yahoo after all, told the board that. Then we learned Yahoo and Google have come to an agreement to run search advertising together. Marketplace's Bob Moon is on the story for us. Hiya, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
So Yahoo stock dropped 10-13% on this news. How come?
Well, that's a sure sign that a lot of people still had hope this was going to be a deal that was going to happen. They'd make a premium when it did. This clearly isn't going to make maverick investor Carl Icahn very happy. He's bought up about 4% of Yahoo's shares in recent weeks, and he's been pushing Yahoo's executives and board of directors, shall we say, vociferously to salvage a deal with Microsoft and get a higher price. Barring that, Icahn has said a partnership with Google would be a second choice. That's apparently what he's going to get.
We're still waiting to find out whether or not that deal gets confirmed. But Bob, talk to me about the antitrust implications here.
Yeah, even before this deal was sealed, there have been complaints that it could stifle competition, it could push online ad rates up. Executives from both companies have been arguing, though, that they don't see a problem with this because, first of all, this is a non-exclusive partnership, not a merger, and they say that they don't set prices for search advertising anyway, that they conduct auctions to sell their ads. But stay tuned.
And indeed we will. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
This morning, the Commerce Department confirmed that American consumers are indeed creatures of habit. We like to spend our money if it's in our pocket. Retail sales rose last month, a full percent, about twice expectations. So where'd we get the extra money to go shopping in a down economy? Thank the stimulus package and those rebate checks. But Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports there are worries it won't help the economy in the long run.
In May alone, the Treasury Department cut about $48 billion worth of rebate checks. Economists say consumers spent at least part of that, but retail analyst Howard Davidowitz says the spending is just a short-term blip.
He is throwing checks out of helicopters to people, and there's a lot of pent-up demand out there. I don't think this changes anything.
And such a small growth spurt won't lead to new jobs, says Michael Darda. He's chief economist at MKM Partners.
No rational business owner is going to start hiring employees based on a temporary spike in sales that they know will reverse. We should have learned that rebates are feckless and phony fiscal policy, but apparently we've learned nothing.
But politicians have learned that voters don't like a tanking economy. Ian Shepherdson is chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics. He says the Bush administration hopes the positive bump lasts through the November elections. But Shepherdson says retail sales might actually nosedive toward the end of the summer. Why? Consumer confidence is still shaky. Look at whose sales increased the most last month.
Save money, live better, Walmart.
Shepherdson isn't surprised that discounters are gaining market share.
That trend will probably run for some time yet, as we discovered that an awful lot of the wealth that we thought we had over the last few years was an illusion.
But high food and energy prices are very real. Shepherdson says when the rebate checks are gone, consumers will slam their wallets shut. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The dollar gained a little ground against the euro today, probably all that talk that Ben Bernanke's been doing about inflation and the chance he'll raise interest rates. But relatively speaking, the greenback's still down deep in the basement, which makes American assets a pretty good bargain. Foreign companies are making noises about buying New York's iconic Chrysler and Flatiron buildings. And for $46 billion, the heart of American beer. Yesterday, the Belgian brewer InBev made a whopper of a bid for Anheuser-Busch. A deal that, if it goes through, would be one of the biggest foreign takeovers of American companies ever. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Brands just don't get much more American than Budweiser. Even the label is red, white, and blue.
You make America work, and this Bud's for you.
Or this Bud's for Belgium? Industry consultant Tom Perko says the deal is likely to go through. And he says even though InBev might say it won't change the brand much, the brand will change.
What people don't understand is these transactions change the culture of a company. Guys are going to come in and cut out a lot of the advertising, change the deals with the distributors, change the whole business formulation. It will be a different company.
But that doesn't mean the InBev Bud deal will make a difference to Joe Sixpack.
Oh, I think as long as people are getting their Bud and their Bud Light, they're going to be darn happy.
That's branding consultant Rob Frankel. He says U.S. consumers like to say they'll buy American, but they don't tend to put their money where their mouths are.
Everybody likes to talk a good game, but they're still buying Chinese imports out of Walmart. So the idea doesn't seem to make it to their pocketbooks.
Frankel says with globalization, most people have no idea who owns what. Motown Records, Wild Turkey, Motel 6 all have foreign owners. Even Jerry Springer, that most American of TV shows, is partly owned by French giant Vivendi. As for picking a patriotic beer, that could get really tricky if InBev gets its way. After all, Miller is part of British giant SABMiller, and Coors joined up with Canada's Molson last year. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Wall Street had a nice little rally going for most of the day. Then the oil market said, we'll be having none of that, thank you. Crude rose, equity stalled. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center has been doing its thing. It's been digging into the tax promises that John McCain and Barack Obama have been making. Take health care out of the equation, and it turns out both candidates would wind up costing the government money. For Obama, $2.7 trillion less in tax revenues over the next 10 years. For McCain, $3.7 trillion. Big numbers. But commentator and economist Glenn Hubbard says it's time to turn the debate from how much Washington's bringing in to how it's being spent.
It's impossible to reduce spending in the near term, right? Wrong. To balance the budget by the end of the next president's term, non-defense spending growth needs to be restrained to inflation. Now, this will be tough. The federal government has been on a bipartisan spending binge for a decade. Compared to the 1997 level, adjusted for inflation and new Homeland Security spending, actual non-defense spending for the decade is $900 billion higher. Now, we can fix this without raising tax rates. But conventional wisdom also says we can't cut spending in the long term. That's because spending on Social Security and Medicare is projected to rise in the coming decades, right? Well, again, no. Spending restraint is our only sensible choice. The Congressional Budget Office tells us that Social Security and Medicare spending left unchecked for the next generation will rise by 10 percentage points of GDP. Ratifying this spending with higher taxes would require an across-the-board tax increase of 60%. We can meet our spending challenges on defense and education and training, but we must do three things. Change entitlements to slow their cost growth by reducing assistance for the better off. Eliminate the binge spending in the remainder of the budget and adopt policies that promote economic growth. The greater economic growth, the larger the economic pie to finance entitlement obligations and other national priorities. Memo to presidential candidates. If you propose to restrain federal spending, tell us how. And if you propose to raise taxes, talk to us about the lost opportunities in economic growth for our country's priorities and dreams.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to run the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. You can share your thoughts with us online. Marketplace.org is the homepage. Artists tend to get stereotyped a lot as slackers or outsiders, somewhere between struggling and starving. But there's a report out today from the Census Bureau that says artsy types pull down a collective $70 billion a year. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
It's easy to resent artists. There's this perception they get to lounge around and think all day while the rest of us crunch numbers and kiss up to the boss. Portland-based visual artist Brian Borello has gotten that vibe on jobs before.
When the artist walks in the room, it's the artist. You know, here comes the wild card.
That's just the notion this National Endowment for the Arts report hopes to dispel. It found that a lot of people work as artists, almost 2 million. That includes everyone from performers to designers to architects. NEA Chairman Dana Gioia says as one of the largest classes of workers, artists deserve more respect.
They produce goods and services that people want. You know, they play a significant part in economic life and in civic life.
But artists have to keep a lot of balls in the air to make a living. The survey found that about a third work only part of the year, and they're more likely to be self-employed. Their numbers doubled between 1970 and 1990. Author Lisa Chamberlain, who wrote the books Lycanomics, says it's the Generation Xers. She says they've expanded the creative economy.
So in 1970, I think an artist was considered somebody with oil paints and an easel. Today, an artist is a singer-songwriter, a multimedia artist.
The salary for all that juggling averages just over $34,000 a year, higher than the U.S. median. But dancer Cynthia Vallone says that figure usually doesn't include benefits we might consider standard.
You don't show up, you don't get paid.
I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There's going to be a big offering from the artists community known as Hollywood in a couple of weeks. Pixar's latest movie is set to hit the screen at the end of the month, and chances are WALL-E will be another box office hit for the Disney subsidiary. It's a pretty safe guess, given Pixar's track record with Monsters, Inc. and The Incredibles and all the rest. But the company's future wasn't always so bright. David Price digs into the history of Pixar in his new book. It's called The Pixar Touch. Mr. Price, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
It probably bears mention that before Pixar was a movie company, it was actually a computer company, a hardware company, right?
That's right. Steve Jobs bought Pixar from George Lucas. It was the computer graphics division of Lucasfilm. He did that in early 86 with the idea that it would be a computer company and make another fortune for him.
Yeah, how did it go?
Well, it didn't quite work out as planned. The Pixar Image Computer was the name of their product. It was a computer to do high-end graphics for universities and places like that. And the total sales were actually in the low three digits. They sold very few of these boxes.
Three as in like a couple of hundred?
That's right.
So how did it come to pass that this really lousy computer company turns into a movie company?
Well, they had this guy named John Lasseter working out of a hallway making short animated films to promote the company's products. The idea was that if you were a tech guy who was in the market for graphics hardware, you'd see one of John Lasseter's shorts at an industry conference and you'd think, oh, I can do this kind of thing with the Pixar image computer. This is really great stuff. And so they never actually meant to make any money off of the stuff he was doing, but he's putting out Luxo Jr. and Tintoy and Red's Dream, and that got the attention of Disney, and that was really their entree into doing feature animation.
And the first feature film they did was Toy Story. What was it about that film that made it the breakthrough for Pixar?
It was groundbreaking artistically, simply because it was the first computer-animated feature film. And they've got an excellent screenwriting team. So you wind up with this really sparkling story, very snappy dialogue. And so that's, I think, the essential element that makes the movie successful.
Do you think Pixar would be what it is without Steve Jobs?
Pixar would not exist without Steve Jobs. He had the willingness to see it through 10 very tough years. There's no venture capitalist in the world, probably, who would have staked that much money. It ran to around $50 million and not see really the prospect of a return on his investment for most of that time.
Let me ask you about the future then. I mean, the next big Pixar film is coming out later this month. It's called WALL-E. What's the buzz? How are you expecting it's going to do?
Well, I think expectations for this film are very high, and I think deservedly so. The character is just enormously appealing. My boys never stop hounding me with the question of, you know, how soon can we see WALL-E? Now, how it's going to be received once it's out is another question, because from what I'm hearing from people who've seen the movie, I haven't seen it myself, the finale is sort of the last third of the movie, let's say, is really quite bleak and apocalyptic. And so depending on how they handle that may have a big effect on how well it does long term.
Yeah, apocalyptic, though, probably doesn't play too well with the kids, huh?
Or their parents.
Or their parents, you know. The book by David Price is called The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company. Mr. Price, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, when life is tough and work is worse.
Most of the people are better off than me, so I usually don't want to smile, but that's all I can do. I can just smile, and I have this smile that is mine.
But first, let's do the numbers. That big Bud bid we talked about earlier put a nice head on the markets early, but oil changed everybody's minds. The Dow climbed 57 points, 0.5%, to close at 12,141. The NASDAQ edged up 10 points, 0.4%, 2404. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, 0.3%, 1339 at the close. Better than expected May retail sales pushed Home Depot up 2%, gave Walmart a 1% bump. Qualcomm jumped 5.75% after a rosy profit report. Yahoo closed down 10%, Microsoft added 4%. Financial institutions generally rose on news that Lehman Brothers is replacing its chief financial officer and its chief operating officer. Lehman gave up 4.4%, but Merrill Lynch climbed 2.3%. Citigroup popped up 3.5%. Overseas, London's FTSE was up 67 points. The Paris CAC 40 climbed 11 points. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From
from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for May. In Paris, President Bush gives a speech at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And on June 13, 1966, the U.S. Supreme Court established the Miranda Warning. Suspects must be informed of their rights before statements can be taken by police. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you want to see how the global economy really works, you have to strip out the big businesses and multinational conglomerates and get down to the basic building block. One person doing a job, trying to get by. Today on our series Working, we take you to where your favorite purse or soccer ball got its start. If it's leather, there's a good chance it came from a tannery in Pakistan. Countries all over the world send their animal skins there to be processed. Tanning is Pakistan's second biggest source of income. But it depends on the work of young men or boys, some as young as 7 or 8, who arrive every day from small villages to find work in big city leather factories. Greg Warner introduces us to one of them.
A few days after Momin turned 13, his dad told him to pack a bag. Momin said goodbye to his village and rode 3 days on a bus until he got here, to the Kurangi, a sprawling industrial zone to the east of Karachi City. It was the first time he'd seen the ocean or a traffic jam. Motorcycles and horse-drawn pushcarts dodged shopkeepers and laborers on foot.
I stayed indoors that very day because I was a little scared of getting out on the streets and getting lost or getting kidnapped.
That was 4 years ago. Now, Momin's used to his morning commute. He kind of glides through the streets in traditional white dress, half smiling as he picks his way over tufts of animal fur. The fur is white and brown and black and covers the dirt road like leaves after a storm. The air smells like a dead dog in the road, he says, but the smell is on every road he goes down.
When I did smell that, I felt like puking for 2-3 days. Although if you see, most of the Kurangi has a lot of trash all around, the smell becomes a part of the life and we get used to it.
We walk along a black canal. Momin warns me not to get too close.
I have been told by people that it is dangerous and it has acid in it and it can burn you, but I really do not know about it.
What's that sound? That...
Yeah, timing.
Timing? It's time to get back to work.
We come to the factory gate. A cart loaded with animal skins pushes past us. Momin and the skins enter the factory. Momin heads to his station. I visit his boss, Shabir Ahmad. Shabir has big cheeks and some gray hair. I find him holding up a scrap of leather next to a jacket. He's trying to match the texture, he says, with skins imported from all over the world.
We import from New Zealand, Australia, Saudi, Somalia.
This factory is turning those skins into identical brown bomber jackets destined for Canada.
There's a lot of people's effort behind this one jacket.
Tanning is a messy, dangerous, and labor-intensive work. That's why so many countries send their hides here to be processed.
The operator puts the chemical on it, and this guy just picks it up and puts it on it. That's about it.
Momin stands next to a pile of nearly finished leather. He picks up each piece and lays it flat on the belt. The skins pass under a machine that sprays them with dye. When he works his way through that pile, he gets more skins.
That's the whole work.
That's the whole work.
It's the job he's done 6 days a week for 4 years. His boss, Shabir, says he doesn't have much else to look forward to.
People get old over here in these factories only, and they don't really change or they don't really become anything better.
How long many years do they have usually?
Until he's healthy.
Until he's healthy, Shabir says. About 22 years, on average. Factory chemicals are toxic. Asthma is common, especially in workers that started young, like Momin. So is cancer. And unlike Shabir, his manager, Momin can't go to the window for fresh air when he feels queasy. He may never have that sort of privilege. Karachi's leather industry isn't booming the way it was a decade ago. It's harder for new arrivals to get ahead, with so many willing to replace them. At lunchtime, I follow Momin back to the room he rents with his older brother, his uncles, and cousins. They sit on the floor, sharing a bowl of lentils with flatbread. I ask him about his work.
Here you are, you speak three languages, you're a bright guy. Is this very boring work for you?
There's a discussion, and then my translator shrugs his shoulders.
The meaning of boredom, he doesn't get it.
Momin doesn't know the word for boredom. It's just not something he thinks about.
Your life seems so hard, and yet when you talk, you're able to smile. Why is that?
Most of the people are better off than me, so I usually don't want to smile, but that's all I can do. I can just smile, and I have this smile that is mine.
The call sounds to afternoon prayer. Momin and his housemates hurry to finish their meals. After lunch, the boys head back to work. Momin's brother, Nurula, works at a different factory where the raw skins are scraped, cleaned, and dried. His job is to wipe blue acid on the hides when they come in. Like turpentine, the acid separates the skin from its fur. He gets paid by the hide, and sometimes he works too quickly. His legs and arms are scarred with acid burns. The next day is Sunday, Momin's day off. Every few Sundays, Momin will call his father back in the village. He uses their group cell phone. They speak in Pashto.
Hello, assalamu alaikum.
How are you? Momin asks his dad. Fine, how are you? It's not much, but Momin's grinning. And then his father makes a request. I'm getting old, his father says. I want to go on the Hajj. The Hajj is the pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia that all Muslims are commanded to do. Momin's smile fades. The Hajj would cost about $3,000. Momin only saves about $60 a month. And that all goes toward family debts. Momin himself doesn't even own a toothbrush. He hasn't visited home in almost 2 years.
How will I go home if I have to keep paying somebody? And that's what I usually do, end up doing. I keep paying people the money that somebody from my family owes.
Sunday is also the day when Momin plays his weekly game of cricket. I follow him past the outdoor billiard hall to a dusty clearing among shrubs. Suddenly, Momin grabs my hand. He leads me away from the cricket game, up a little hill. Up here, you can see the Karachi skyline. The city sprawls for miles, but Momin points down at a donkey grazing in a field. I come here every Sunday, Momin tells me.
But why? Why do you like to come here?
It looks like his village, he says. Even the crops are the same.
The wheat would have grown over there and vegetables grow over there. Mostly similar stuff.
We stand there a moment, quiet. And then Momin turns and runs down to the game.
Come on,
it's getting late. And there's only a few hours before sunset left to play.
Greg Warner went to Pakistan to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see some pictures of Momin and hear all the profiles in the series on our website. The link is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, on a day when oil closed at almost $137 a barrel, the world's biggest publicly traded oil company is getting out of the retail gas business. The Dallas Morning News reports that ExxonMobil is going to sell off its 2,200 owned or leased gas stations. Despite what you might imagine given those prices, profit margins in corner gas stations are actually pretty slim. You will still see Exxon and Mobil stations out there, though, about 10,000 of them. Exxon sells its brand and its gas to other distributors.
That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow hiked up 57 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ rose 10 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 added 4 points, about 0.3% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, John Haas, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, adding golden trifles to a truffle.
It definitely, you know, attracts your eye, and I'm sure that a lot of people just want to eat it just because it has gold on it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.